Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Four people accuse Eva Lopez Chavez, a Salt Lake City council member, of unwanted sexual advances. It's never been this bad, how Utahns are coping with the topsy-turvy economy. Utah takes the lead in measles cases, but COVID made health officials cautious to encourage vaccines. And she was a false prophet's wife. Now she's reclaiming her life after years of control and abuse. Those are the headlines we'll be talking about today. Later in the program, we'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune State Watch reporter Addie Baird, investigative reporter Jessica Schreifels, and lead visual journalist Trent Nelson. And as part of the program, we bring in politics reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, good morning, Tom.
Good morning. We'll also be talking with reporter Peyton Harkins. Peyton, thank you.
Of course, thank you.
Let's start with you, Robert. That headline, four people accuse Eva Lopez Chavez of unwanted sexual advances. Tell us first who Lopez Chavez is.
Yeah, she's a city councilwoman in Salt Lake City. She's a young woman, and she's 29, I believe, and she's she's LGBTQ and Latina. So she had sort of this intriguing political profile. She's running for the first congressional district in that crowded field that we've talked about on here before. And, you know, heading into the convention Saturday, it was going to be kind of, touch and go for her to see if she was going to make it onto the primary ballot. And then this story dropped Wednesday evening was when we posted it, with these allegations from these four women, three of whom are elected officials. Her fellow council member, Victoria Petro, State Senator Jen Plum and State Representative Hong Nguyen, and then another woman, Maggie Ruggieri, who was working on a campaign when she said her encounter or incident with Lopez Chavez occurred.
Interesting, at least one of these accusers said they came forward at this point because of Lopez Chavez's statements about Nate Bloom.
Yeah, honestly, I think they all kind of, that was a motivating factor for all of them. And we've talked about it on the program, but just over a week ago, it came out that Nate had been posting on some online forums, and the posts were, I think offensive to a lot of people, disparaging of the LDS church and making crude sexual jokes and disparaging comments, slurs for, disabled people and so forth. There was a lot of reaction, a lot of reaction to that story breaking. And Lopez Chavez gave one of the sort of strongest condemnations of it and said he should drop out of the race and was really outspoken about how we have to protect women and, we need to respect them and, we shouldn't ever make light of these sort of, sexual assault. And it was, I think they all just viewed it as kind of over the top and tone deaf, given their prior experiences, what they said were their prior experiences with her and the abuse that they'd suffered at her hands. We probably need to note right out front that she has said that in three of the instances, there was no inappropriate conduct. And she says the fourth one never actually occurred. She doesn't know anything, about it. So, she is denying having, engaged in this misconduct and has said that she's willing or eager to defend herself and wants an investigation and intends to stay working on the city council.
So take us through these accusations. What are these women saying that Lopez Chavez did?
Yeah, they all kind of have a common theme in that they all allege that she either pushed them up against a wall and wouldn't let them go, or and in some instances made lewd comments toward them. In Victoria's case, they were at a wedding after party, and Victoria said that Eva grabbed her by the throat, pushed her against the wall, and made a sexual advance, a sexually inappropriate comment. I don't think we can say it on the air. And similarly in Hong Nguyen's case, Hong was giving her a ride to her car after a political event and said that she climbed over the console and pinned her to the seat and said she wasn't going to get off of her until she gave her a kiss. And Jen Plum's, they were at a a different political event. And, oh no, I'm sorry, hers was at a birthday party. And Senator Plum says that Ava pushed her against a wall, grabbed her backside, and said, asked her if she's sure that she's straight. And in Maggie's case, it was at a political or not a political fundraiser, a fundraiser for the Human Rights Campaign. And similarly, Ava pushed her against the wall and wouldn't let her go. Somebody else had to step in and pull her off of her, is how she put it. So there's that common theme that they said establishes a pattern of behavior. I think it was Representative Wynn referred to, said she, at the time she didn't view it as sexual assault, but she said that, if a man had done the same thing to her, it certainly would have been. And she now considers Lopez Chavez to be, as she put it, a sexual predator.
So Lopez Chavez's attorney, Greg Scordis, a prominent attorney, he's making specific counter arguments. What is he saying?
Well, he said in some of the instances there are text messages that show that it never occurred, or it didn't occur in the way that they are representing it to be. In the incident with Senator Plum, she said that, or Greg said that that never occurred. She doesn't have any recollection of anything like that, and they remain friends, and she would produce text messages to prove that. It was kind of interesting. In response to that, Senator Plum did provide her text exchanges with Ava, and in June of 2025, the council member invited the senator to an event, and she declined. And then in February, she asked her to meet because of some things that Representative, or sorry, Council Member Chavez had said that she'd heard that Senator Plum was telling people about their interactions, that she wanted to clear the air, and she got left on read on that one. She didn't reply at all. So, it's one of these things that had it just been one individual or anonymous individuals, the story might not have carried as much weight as it did. But in this instance, we have four women, all of whom are, well, three of whom at least are elected representatives and have, a reputation in the community, and they're coming forward and willing to put their names to this. That's they don't have much to gain from this, right? I mean, this is not something that they're doing out of spite. I don't think it's something that is, that they're doing because, from what they told me, the reason they're doing it is that they want to make sure that other people who aren't in the privileged positions that they're in don't experience the same sort of thing.
The Salt Lake City Council chair, in February, you note, directed the executive director of the council to review council policies. Was that based on reports about Lopez Chavez?
It was, yeah. I mean, there was an email that Council Chair Alejandro Puy sent to the executive director for the council, directing her to do this review of the code of conduct for that applies to council members. It's kind of when we're dealing with council members, they aren't governed by the city's human resources policy, and so they were trying to make sure that they had something in place where if issues arose, staff or others could feel comfortable coming to the council with a complaint process. And so he specifically referenced that there had been allegations made against Council Member Lopez Chavez, alleging misconduct, and that was the impetus for this a pattern of behavior, I think, is how he put it in the email. That review is still ongoing, so they haven't enacted a new policy yet, but it is in the pipeline. I guess we should also note that Council Member Lopez Chavez has says that she has filed two complaints with the city regarding the treatment that she's feels she's on the receiving end of from Council Member Petro and Council Member Puy. She feels like they're mistreating her as a fellow colleague, and those again are still in the process.
Are others speaking out now these accusations have come public?
Well, that's kind of hard. We have talked to other people who weren't willing to go on the record with their experiences, And so it's kind of, there's not a whole lot I can tell you about that, but there are others that we've talked to who just, out of fear of retribution, retaliation, or whatever, have chosen not to put their names to it, and not to allow us to print details of what occurred. I think it's fair to say that they are fairly similar to these others. Yeah.
What about elected officials, others of that type? Are they making statements?
Sorry, you mean the reaction to the story?
Reaction to the story.
So the Utah the state Democratic Party, the county Democratic Party, sorry, the legislative Democrats all issued statements expressing concern, I guess is the best way to put it, about this report, and expressing support for women who have been victimized in ways like this. I don't think, I'm thinking back on the comments exactly. None of them, I think, were calling for resignations or anything like that. But they do express their concern and would like to see some inquiry into this.
So convention is this weekend, I believe.
Yeah. So this is that's kind of the unfortunate timing of this story, frankly, from our part, is like it would have been better for us had it not come so close to the convention. We considered not running the story before the convention, but we also felt like it would be worse if we didn't, and the readers thought that we were withholding information from them, so we ran it when we did. As of last night, Councilmember Lopez Chavez doesn't have the enough signatures to qualify for the primaries. So unless that changes, the future of her campaign is riding on her ability to get 40% in the convention on Saturday. If she doesn't, then her campaign's over, and she'll remain as a councilman, obviously a council member, and but it will be the end of her congressional bid. And there's also speculation that she's interested in running for mayor of Salt Lake down the road. But we have to kind of wait and see how this impacts the potential for that to happen.
Well, thank you for telling us about this. We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune politics reporter Robert Gerke. Thanks.
Thanks, Tom.
Let's turn next to this story. It's never been this bad, how Utahns are coping with the topsy-turvy economy. We bring on Salt Lake Tribune reporter Peyton Harkins. Peyton, thank you.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So first here, you and some colleagues went and talked to a bunch of people, how people in Utah are coping with this topsy-turvy economy. I guess, first of all, you talked to at least one economist. What does he say is producing this upheaval in the economy?
I mean, there's a few things, and that's, I think, kind of the deal with the economy right now. But the main factor is there's uncertainty. I mean, we have higher oil prices because of this, this war in Iran that affects basically every part of Utah's economy, which we get into in the story, because of how Utah is landlocked. We just feel the squeeze of these oil prices more. And I mean, that affects everything we buy at the store, that because the trucks, obviously take fuel to get the goods that we need in Utah here. Inflation continues to be higher than we'd like it to be, and our unemployment rate the employment rate is decreasing, but our labor force's participation is also dropping, and so it's just like a weird economy right now. And so people, it's good for some people and bad for others. It seems like this story, we found a lot of people who were struggling.
No, people do in general feel a little better about Utah's economy than the nation as a whole.
Yeah, and that tends to be the case in Utah, but it's like, our job growth was 0.6, which slightly exceeded US job growth, which was 0.2. It's like, and these are all both below historical averages. So while it might be a little better in Utah than the country, the average for the country, it's still not great here.
Let's go down through these areas, starting with gas. What are people saying? How is this affecting them?
I mean, I talked to this woman who lives in Iron County. She's a recently retired grandma who was so looking forward in her retirement to being able travel to, help her kids out by watching her grandkids. And she also has a disabled son that lives in St. George, who she, goes and sees every other week. And because of these gas prices, she's having to cut down on those trips. So it's like she used to go see her son every other week. Now she's going about once a month. She has like a 3-year-old granddaughter who lives in, I believe, Spanish Fork, and she was, really looking forward to be able to watch her, and she hasn't been able to do that. And it's just, I don't, it's just people aren't able to live the lives they had envisioned because of these gas prices. Yeah, and I think everybody's feeling that.
You talked to the owner of a coffee house. How's this? You say definitely squeezed is his quote. How's this affecting him?
Yeah, and this was my colleague Colby Peterson, our food and drink reporter, actually talked to the owner of Buzzed Coffee House. And he was just saying that basically the price of everything they need at the coffee shop has risen. Like for the past, oh, I want to say maybe a year, coffee prices, like just the coffee beans prices, has been higher because there have been droughts in the parts of the world where we get coffee, like Brazil, for instance. And so that had already been going up, but now it's like, the alternative milks that they're using to make your lattes, like oat milk or almond milk or whatever, those are going up. Like the price of cups are going up, the price of chocolate sauce. I mean, just anything that you might need in a coffee shop outside of coffee, all that's going up. And so he's had to raise prices. He's instituted kind of a sort of dynamic pricing system for your alternative milks. If you get a medium drink, it costs a certain amount, but that'll be different than if you get a large drink. I mean, he's just trying to make up for it in whatever way he can.
Certain to cars, people buying cars, it's, I guess, understandably, people are maybe looking at electric vehicles.
Yeah, which is interesting that we're seeing this kind of bump in people looking for EVs because, there used to be sort of federal incentives to get these EVs, and those lapsed last year. And so you would maybe expect that, without those incentives, people would, just go for the standard and often cheaper sort of gas vehicles. But no, because of these gas prices, people are looking more at EVs than they have before, which, was a real boon for this used EV dealer that I talked to. He was telling me that he sold 20% more vehicles this March than he did last March. And, last March they still had those federal incentives. And just, want to mention sort of across the board, the wholesale prices of used cars are going up, not just EVs. And so it seems like, people are trying to save some money by getting new to them vehicles and not necessarily new vehicles right now.
What about housing? How's the economy affecting housing in Utah?
My colleague Megan Banta is the one who spoke to the Utah Association of Realtors, but they were telling her that they've seen a 7% increase in the number of closings on homes since last March. So, March 2005 compared to March 2026. And they say that this is, in part due to a drop in mortgage rates. Like right now, it's at about 6.35%. And so those are a little bit lower. And what I thought was kind of interesting in this story, though, was that people seem to be willing to kind of give up on their wish list for houses. Maybe they're willing to have, less bedrooms, or maybe, just the 1.5 bath is fine, or something like that. And so people are also seeming to compromise a little bit more on what they want to.
Of course, gas is up. Diesel is also up. That's going to affect trucking. We all depend on trucks to get us our goods. How's this affecting trucking companies?
So it kind of depends on what kind of trucking company it is. Like I mentioned earlier, that since we're landlocked, all of our goods basically get to us through these trucks. And so, and diesel prices have been rising. The diesel is generally more than gas, and so they're feeling it. And so I talked to a trucking company in Tremonton, and he was telling me that like their fuel spend for the entirety of 2024 and 2025, basically per week, was somewhere around 55 to 60K. And in recent weeks, when the price of crude oil has been like hovering around $100 a barrel, that's gone up to 95K to 100-ish K, which is, quite an increase. But he was saying that like the way their contract structure works, they will eventually sort of get returns on this gas that they're paying right now. It'll just come about a month late. And so they're not actually feeling too squeezed by it right now, just knowing that they'll get that cash. But like other trucking companies that don't have this same structure, I mean, they're probably losing out on money. And the trucking industry has just been facing like, like a series of challenges since probably the end of the pandemic sort of era. You know, they've had difficulties hiring, retaining people, and just kind of getting back to normal after supply chains were disrupted. But it seems like the sentiment in the trucking industry is that if supply chains stay disrupted, like they will basically be able to get more money per tonnage of freight that they're shipping, you know, and so it's like there will be less supply and more demand, and so therefore this might actually be a boon for the trucking industry, even though they're paying these higher fuel prices.
I could guess gas prices high. Some people might be looking to get on the bike. You talk to a bicycle shop owner. What are bike sales up?
It is for Guthrie Bicycle, which is, you know, in Sugar House, in Salt Lake City. They were telling me that they've seen both increases in the amount of bikes they're selling and also people willing to spend more on repairs for these bikes. You know, maybe somebody doesn't want to get, you know, a new bike necessarily because they're trying to save money, but they're going to spend a little bit more on the upgraded tune or, you know, getting, you know, different, you know, I don't know, equipment or whatever put on their bikes to make it easier to ride because they're going to be riding it more this spring. And it's kind of interesting because in Utah, it's like a lot of times when people hang up their skis and snowboards for the season, they kind of switch to mountain biking. And this year, since the snow was so terrible for skiing and snowboarding, a lot of bikers were able to continue biking during the winter. So it's like there's some theory that maybe people are, you know, getting these more expensive tunes just because like they've used their bike more this winter than they might have at this time last year or something like that. But I don't know. One could look at the fuel prices and look at an increase in bike sales and say that maybe fuel prices have something to do with it too.
A couple of minutes left in this segment. I want to make sure we get food in. Of course, that's everybody needs food. What about grocery prices? What are people saying?
It seems like they're rising across the board. I mean, that person, the grandmother that I was talking to earlier, we had a conversation about it. She went to the store recently and, you know, wanted to get some grapes, and she saw that they were about $5 a pound, and she was like, "Wow, I'm not going to get grapes." And I mean, she's told me that she is backing off on, you know, things like beef. You know, like beef prices are so much higher than they used to be for ground beef and things like that, and so a lot of people are switching to chicken and pork. Pork is actually down a little bit, which I think is interesting. But the Utah Food Bank has also been seeing sort of the repercussions of these high food prices, and they're seeing a lot of people show up to get, you know, groceries and things like that.
Then you talked to Jeanette Bott, of course, Utah Food Bank. She's saying there's ripple effects, right? If you have higher fuel prices, can't get to work, don't earn a paycheck, then it takes a long time for families to recover.
Yeah, no, definitely it can. And, you know, some of these families have been in these dire straits for longer than just since this war started, you know, and so you can see how these effects are really going to start compounding and, you know, hurting people.
What about public transit? Are people using that more?
That's what UTA tells me. They were a little bit cautious with these numbers. They said that, you know, they like to have a little bit more of a sample size in about a month-ish, which is, you know, the war started at the very end of February. And so we were looking at March data. And so, you know, take that with a grain of salt, but they're telling me that ridership last month in March outpaced March 2025 ridership by 3%. And they're seeing really big gains in bus ridership, which honestly kind of surprised me. Like I thought that we might see an increase in front runner, for instance, you know, the people that have these longer commutes, you know, on the highway and stuff like that might decide to take the train, but it seems like the shorter trips in town or something like that on buses are actually getting more ridership. That was up about 100,000 more this March compared to March 2025.
It looks like we have about a minute to time to fit in this interesting final piece of your story. Even in the uncertain economy, you talked to a couple who decided, well, we're going to launch our business.
Yeah, that is the Rug Lounge in 9th and 9th. They, you know, it's something that they've been thinking about doing for a while, and They just decided to do it. They compared it to having a baby. They said there's probably not going to feel like a perfect time to do it. It's a leap, and so they're just they're taking that leap and seeing what will happen. And they understand that it might be hard. Linda, the woman in the couple that talked to us said, people, they're thankful that people are willing to spend the money to get out of the house and be in the community during this time when people don't have a lot of money to spend. So they're hoping that that community aspect can maybe get people out of the house,
Well, thanks for this snapshot, overall view of many different areas of the economy. Peyton Harkins, thank you.
Thank you.
And we have been on this part of the program talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Peyton Harkins. Appreciate that. And politics reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely.
And coming up following a break, we're going to head to this headline. Utah leads the nation in measles cases, but COVID made health officials cautious to encourage vaccines. We'll be talking with State Watch reporter Addie Baird. Hope you stay with us for Behind the Headlines following this break.
If you love discovering new music, Utah Public Radio invites you to tune in to the Corner Concert Series. This month, we're bringing you all of April's Corner Concerts together in 1 hour. Hear from Luke Weston, The Narcs, and Kin. Catch the Corner Concert Series 1 hour special this Friday at 10 a.m. and this Saturday at 3 p.m. only on Utah Public Radio.
What is jazz? Jazz is as varied and diverse as Utah itself. It has high peaks and low valleys. It can be glossy, it can be gritty, it can be lush, it can be very sparse. It can rush like a river or flow like a calming stream, and it is rooted in tradition while always embarking on new directions. I'm John, your host for The Edge of Jazz, Sunday nights at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. And we bring in next State Watch reporter Addie Baird. Addie, thanks so much.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So here's your interesting story from this week. Utah leads the nation in measles cases, but COVID made health officials cautious to encourage vaccines. First line here, recent weeks, Utah has become the epicenter of the national measles outbreak. So how bad is it? How many cases? Where are they located?
Yeah, it's pretty bad. So as of now, there have, as of the last reporting from the Department of Health and Human Services, which was on Tuesday, there have been 607 measles cases here in the state of Utah. And a lot of those cases have been concentrated in the southern part of the state in southwestern Utah.
So what are health officials saying? I guess there'd be state officials, there'd be those officials in southwest Utah. Are they talking? Are they pushing vaccines?
It's a really interesting line that these health officials are walking. What we know and what health officials have said, without a doubt, that vaccines are effective and they are the most effective way to prevent getting the measles and any other disease. But because there is a significant population of people who are vaccine skeptical here in the state of Utah, there is some concern that pushing that message too hard could backfire. And there is some concern that that message coming from the state officials could really, again, backfire and not actually get people to get vaccinated. So both the state and the more local and regional health departments have been pushing messaging saying vaccines are proven effective and really reminding people of the science rather than saying, get your vaccination.
Do we know what vaccination rates are? Are people getting their MMR?
Yeah, we have a pretty good sense. One of the ways that we know that we're able to estimate is through our public school system. And people who have children in the public schools need to either get vaccinated or submit vaccine exemptions. And about 90% of our public school students here in the state of Utah are vaccinated. And the data from DHHS says that that holds true about at the same amount among adult populations. So we think about 90% of Utahns are vaccinated for measles, have that MMR vaccine.
So, according to your story, officials in Southwest Utah are seeing a slight uptick in parents bringing children in for the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. What do they think is happening there?
Yeah, there was at least a couple of physicians who told my colleague that there is this slight uptick, and it's from people who have maybe been hesitant or have maybe been behind on their vaccinations, that when faced with the reality of measles, come in and get their kid vaccinated. So they're also, one of the things that the state epidemiologist, Dr. Nolan, told me was that that has been the most effective thing driving down measles numbers here in the state. There have been some communities, she said, who saw a couple cases and people were very scared and banded together and got vaccinated. And that has been a really effective form of literally inoculating people.
Now, of course, COVID, with recent experience, of course, the difference with COVID is nobody was vaccinated. Nobody was immunized because it was new. 90%-ish vaccinated against measles. But still, the numbers aren't where they need to be for the herd immunity, I guess.
Exactly. And it's interesting because when you look at when you kind of dig into the numbers from DHHS, almost every single case of the measles so far has been in someone who is not vaccinated. Again, there are 607 cases so far in the state. 514 of them have been among people who have not been vaccinated. However, 61 people who have been vaccinated have gotten the measles. And then there's that little bit of about 36 people whose status is unknown. So even though the mass number of people who have gotten sick have been unvaccinated, it's a risk still, even for people who are vaccinated. The vaccine is the best protection, that there's no doubt about that. But anyone who has it could put their neighbors at risk, their loved ones at risk.
You include here an example from South Carolina. They health officials there approached their measles outbreak differently than in Utah.
Yes, that's right. South Carolina was, until very recently, the epicenter of the measles outbreak here in the States. And they had nearly 1,000 cases. And they really had something more of a COVID-esque response. They had weekly press conferences. They had mobile health clinics. They quarantined unvaccinated people exposed to the virus. And it was seemingly very effective. They have not had new cases in a month. And even though they have more cases total with 997, that epicenter of this outbreak has now moved to Utah after it seems that the measures that they took really seem to work.
Yeah, I'm just speculating here. And I wonder why South Carolina and Utah, both red states, you would seem have anti-vax people as similar levels in both states, but different approach, I guess, in South Carolina.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I had the exact same thought. It's not like we're comparing Utah and New York or Utah and California. Seems almost more of an apples to apples comparison of two Republican states, but again, South Carolina took a pretty different approach. I wonder, I will say, if some of it just has to do with the difference between even 600 cases and 900 cases. When you get up into about 1,000 cases, it's much more statistically likely that someone will die. And that's something that we had been wondering about here in Utah, is if we saw this get up to 800, 900 cases, would we start to see a response more like South Carolina?
Mm-hmm. Can officials predict kind of the shape of this epidemic? What might be, is it waning, or would you think it's still going strong?
So we have had had 5 new cases since the DHHS last reported the numbers on April 14th. So that is a significant amount of time without a major uptick in cases. That is a downward trend of the numbers that we have seen recently. And the state epidemiologist told me that she does believe that that downward trend is correct and will continue. So there definitely is optimism that we're on the wane.
One health official said they're working with religious leaders to help get the word out, thinking they're trusted leaders. Maybe people listen to them.
Yes, that was, again, the state epidemiologist, Dr. Nolan. And this is part of the state's strategy. They feel, as I mentioned earlier, that having a having this message of get vaccinated, here's how to approach the measles, coming from the state, you know, elected government officials in Salt Lake City, is not necessarily going to resonate with people and not necessarily going to be effective. And instead, they think that the most important thing is education, and that that education come from people in communities, particularly communities with high rates of unvaccinated people, should hear from people that they actually trust. So that has included in their efforts the more local regional health departments, who are a little closer to the people on the ground. But it has also included religious leaders. She didn't explicitly say this, but I imagine that that means bishops, that means LDS bishops and LDS leaders talking to their communities in a lot of cases. Because it is really, those are trusted people in the community, and Dr. Nolan told me that she thinks that that's going to be a lot more effective than even someone like her, a scientist from Salt Lake City who works for the government, telling people how to approach and respond to this outbreak.
Dr. Nolan also said, I thought this was interesting, she said you could make it more available. You could have pop-up vans, you know, pop-up clinics and the like. But if people don't want the vaccine, they're not going to get the vaccine.
Exactly. She said that when I was asking her about the comparisons to COVID and the comparisons to how South Carolina has responded to the measles. As you said, it was different because with COVID, no one was vaccinated. And again, we think that about 90% of Utahns have already been vaccinated for the measles, have had the MMR vaccine. According to Dr. Nolan, about 50% of people who are not vaccinated here in the state of Utah are not vaccinated, not because they don't have access to the vaccine, but because they have chosen not to be vaccinated. And as she said, in those instances, you could go and knock on those people's doors with the vaccine and they wouldn't take it. So it's not quite the same as COVID, where there was absolutely an appetite among a lot of the people who needed the vaccine to get the vaccine. There's not as much of an appetite among the unvaccinated population for the clinics that, you know, we saw the style of during COVID.
I'm sure you'll be keeping an eye on this, reporting on this. Anything else you'd like to say about this story?
I would just say, you know, it's going to be really interesting to see how things unfold over the next couple of weeks and to see if the trend continues downward. It is always interesting when Utah is number one in something in the national news, but this is a little bit of a scary one for us to be leading out on. So we'll see how things unfold over the next few weeks.
Yeah, we will. You're listening to Behind the Headlines. We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune State Watch reporter Addie Baird. Addie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
You are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Following a break, we are going to talk about this headline. She was a false prophet's wife. Now she's reclaiming her life after years of control and abuse. We'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune investigative reporter Jessica Schreifels, also Salt Lake Tribune lead visual journalist Trent Nelson. That'll be coming up following this break.
Next time on LA Theater Works, the legendary rise and fall of an American energy giant.
Today, I'm pleased to announce the appointment of Jeffrey Skillen to the post of president of the Enron Corporation.
Enron by Lucy Prebble, next time on LA Theater Works.
Tune in Friday night at 9 here on UPR.
The This is Ira Glass. On This American Life, we look for stories that are surprising, that you won't hear anywhere else. Like, for example, this one astronaut who went to the moon. You know what he's not into? Space.
Was it cool to float around weightless?
No.
Unexpected stories every week. This American Life.
Tune in Saturday mornings at 10 here on UPR.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Here is the headline we're going to turn to next. She was a false prophet's wife. Now she's reclaiming her life after years of control and abuse. We bring in Salt Lake Tribune investigative reporter Jessica Schreifels. Jessica, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You bet. And we also bring in lead visual journalist Trent Nelson. Trent, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here. Thank you, Tom.
So we're talking about Noam's Bistline. I guess born Naomi, but goes by Noam's now. You recently did a profile, met her down there in Short Creek, right? Give us a little background, I guess, either one of you or both. She was part of the Samuel Bateman group, I believe.
Yeah, so Noam's Bistline grew up in an FLDS family, and as things were splintering and Warren Jeff's leadership was kind of falling away, a lot of these families were looking for a way to continue the things that were so important to them, like raising children and so forth, that Warren Jeff's had banned. And so Samuel Bateman and a couple other guys started to decide that Warren was speaking through them and that they could start doing these things again, having marriages and kids. And as Samuel gained power over a group of ultimately about 50 people, he began collecting young 20-something year-old women to marry him. And he married two right away, and they began to have children. And so Noam's comes into the picture as the person that Bateman wanted to be his third wife. And she ends up holding out for a little over a year and ends up being wife number 13 as Bateman is just collecting more and more young women. And the process for that is, from the way Noam's describes it, is like a daily barrage of, you know, you've got to be with me, you're supposed to be with me, God has given you to me. And after, you know, a little over a year of this from Bateman and from the rest of the people that she's living with or that are caring for her, she just basically gives in and surrenders to this idea.
So Bateman eventually was arrested, right? Convicted. Now he's serving a long sentence for sexual abuse of underage girls who were his wife, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. So as Trent mentioned, like, he was marrying women in their early 20s, but he also was taking as his wives and having sexual contact with young girls, the youngest being 9 years old. And so he was arrested a couple of years ago, and I think it was in December 2025, he was sentenced to 50 years in federal prison. So he's kind of out of the community now, which has given some of these women, like Noam's, you know, a little bit more space or freedom to kind of get away from that group if they wanted to.
So Noam's Bistline spent some time in prison. This resulted, I think, from an order that Bateman gave to his wives from jail.
Yeah, so the state took these nine underage wives, you know, really victims more than, you know, wives is a term that we need to know, but victims. And the state took them into custody. And Bateman came up with this plan to have his followers go and basically kidnap these minor girls. And they end up, three of his wives end up carrying out this plan, including Noam's, and they get eight of these girls, and they're on the run for a little less than a week before they're found. And oddly enough, Bateman is in his jail cell on a tablet on a video call as the kidnapping is going on, as the people are on the run, and he's, you know, calling in on a video call to the van as they're driving up the freeway. It's something you couldn't even make up. But then Noam's ends up in jail and in prison, and that's really where she hits a rock bottom and realizes she's alone, she's on her own, she's got to make her own choices here. No one's going to help her out. And she, at that point, seems to kind of embrace making her own decisions for the first time, figuring out what she wants to do with her life. And after the judge lets her out early, after she pleads guilty, you know, that's where she kind of ends up now, is just, you know, this vibrant person figuring things out. And like an 18-year-old just out of high school, any option, you know, just the feeling of any option, you can go anywhere, do anything, you know, what's next? What do I want to do?
Hmm. She talks about what Bateman would do. Her quote, he just broke us down and started building us into what he wanted us to be. That was, seems like pressure, abuse, right? At least, at the very least, emotional abuse with her.
Yeah, definitely. The way she describes it is a pretty brutal existence. And while in the Netflix documentary that's been such a hit recently showing this, you see Gnomes on camera a lot, sitting next to Bateman and kind of this adoring follower. But as she describes to us, the minute the cameras are gone, it's back to this brutality, emotional abuse, belittling, and people being, you know, in their term, you know, corrected in front of everybody, or having to atone for some made up misdeed. There's even a series of kind of desert hideouts that he establishes. And one of them is a place that he'll have a wife who he feels isn't, you know, behaving properly, you know, have to stay at this campsite in the middle of nowhere for, you know, days or weeks.
So Gnomes Beislein went, after got out of prison, went back to Short Creek. What did she do at that point?
Yeah, she was lucky to have some family who were willing to, you know, help her out, obviously, and give her a place to stay and just kind of help her get back on her feet. And the woman, Christine Marie, who kind of was instrumental in kind of getting Bateman arrested, collecting the evidence and so forth, also was like offering support and just giving her a chance to get back. And since then, she's had a number of experiences promoting the documentary, being able to go to New York City a couple times and just, you know, really see things that she'd never been exposed to. I spoke to her last year. She came to Salt Lake and we had a meeting, and, you know, this is somebody who wants an education and so forth, but hadn't been made aware of like what colleges are in Utah. You know, she was so isolated and just didn't have certain knowledge that a lot of us just take for granted. So just was soaking in every little bit of information and applying that to what she wants to do with her life.
She connected, I think, with other former wives of Bateman. They've supported each other.
Yeah, that's right. There's been a couple other wives who have followed similar paths, who have left the Bateman group. And, you know, they've kind of been the support for one another and been able, they've had this, you know, shared traumatic experience, and they can talk about that now. And I really loved the story that she told us about, you know, Trent mentioned how there were these desert camps, and there was a time where her and some of the other former wives went back to those camps and did what she called, like, they desecrated it. You know, they put on their swimsuits and they sang these rage songs against Bateman, and they just had a really good time together. And so I think that that's, you know, one example of the way that these women are supporting one another and kind of taking back the power that was taken from them when they were forced into these marriages and into these really strict circumstances.
So at a certain point, you guys write that she was lead singer in a prison band. She discovered, I don't know if she knew she could sing, but that point she was singer.
Yeah, and all through like an FLDS childhood that she had, and even with Bateman, there's a lot of music involved. There's a lot of singing. Families have you know, religious services together on a daily basis, and hymns are a big part of that, and religious songs. So she always had the singing down. I think prison really gave her a chance to realize she had a lot of talent, and also like breaking out into songs that she might not have been exposed to, living in a secluded, you know, more fundamentalist environment. So she's kind of embraced more her style now, that the music she's writing now is more like rock music is how she describes it, and she's listening to a lot of pop stars and really trying to pursue, you know, how do I make this work as a musician? Can I have can this be at least a hobby, but maybe even a career?
So a possible career, what else is she hoping to do?
She's been doing some modeling. She's been studying psychology to try to also figure out what happened, you know, with her. You can see when we see her, you get a real sense that she's enjoying fashion and dressing, you know, finding outfits that have a look that she's after. And I think she's also just enjoying getting out to different places. She's been, as far as I know, like San Diego, like I said, New York, and even just coming up to Salt Lake City, to a bigger city than a small, you know, desert town where she's spent so much of her life, just figuring out what the world is.
Extraordinary experience. She's still in Shark Creek, I guess, but she says once she leaves, she'll leave for good.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, she's there for now. I think that she's, you know, trying to figure out kind of what her next steps are. She has a lot of dreams and ambitions, and figuring out, you know, where to kind of start that. She's still working through it. But yeah, she said that, you know, Shore Creek is a place that did hold a lot of trauma for her, and she wants to make peace with the place. But then when she leaves, she doesn't have any plans to come back.
Mm-hmm. Anything else you guys like to say about this story?
You know, I mean, I'll just say, seeing Gnomes for the first time right after Bateman was arrested, and seeing this person just in a total state of shock and confusion, she was just so, the emotions were so visible on her face, and I was covering that raid, and I'll never forget that kind of look. And to then, you know, nearly 3 years later, be able to see her again in a totally different situation, with a totally different outlook and making her own decisions. It was really uplifting. And I know a lot of the victims aren't necessarily at that same point, and that the healing journey is going to be long for a lot of these victims. But in this case, it's really positive to see such a healing going on.
Well, thank you both for telling us about this. We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune lead visual journalist Trent Nelson. Trent, thank you.
Thank you.
And Salt Lake Tribune investigative reporter Jessica Schreifels. Jessica, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
You are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams, and I hope you'll join us again next time.